Hello, friends, and welcome to Out of This World Radio with your host, Ted Marr, broadcasting from the studios of KKNW here on 1150 AM in Bellevue, Washington, just across the way from Seattle in North America in planet Earth in the Milky Way galaxy. We are the fastest-growing metaphysical and radio UFO radio program in the world with listeners in over 60 countries, and I'm so happy you could be here today because we have a guest on for the next 2 hours. His name is Randy Kramer. And his interview will be truly, I guarantee, out of this world. But we'll get to Randy in just a second. The program itself focuses on out-of-this-world information, including psychic phenomena, UFOs, metaphysics, and predictions for the coming years in Seattle, the United States, and beyond. The purpose of this program is to raise consciousness and make this planet a far better and far happier place. I'm so happy you could join us today. Out of This World Radio is supported entirely by donations, and for those who'd like to donate, please go to the donate button at the upper right-hand corner of the program webpage at www.outofthisworld1150.com and just click on it. Even a dollar will help. And for those who'd like a reading, please contact me. My accuracy rate for readings is between 90 to 100%. My email is outofthisworld1150@gmail.com, and I can also be reached at 509-750-9793 or 1-888-879-8339. Just a couple of things. I want to make a couple of short announcements, and then we'll bring Randy here on the air. I've been sponsoring a wonderful workshop by Japan's most famous spiritual healer, a gentleman named Ray Chandran. He's at the Interfaith Community Sanctuary over on 67th Northwest in Ballard. That's where I was today earlier. He also will be giving another workshop tomorrow from about 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. at the same location in Ballard. If you'd like to go, the cost is just $100 with a 50% discount for students and low income. And I hope you can. He's an amazing man, and we're so lucky to have Ray here. He's one of the world's best, and he has a wide international following for his work. I wanted to tell you, too, that I will be giving there's a wonderful a Boeing Employees Parapsychology Fair coming up here in Kent, Washington on the 25th of July. I'll be there giving readings. And I also want to tell you that I'll also be out at Ocean Shores for their Ocean Shores Body and Soul Festival in Ocean Shores, Washington on the August 8th and 9th. And finally, from August 19th to the 23rd, I'll be one of the speakers at the Rob Potter's wonderful Mount Shasta Spiritual Conference. I'll be bringing on Rob in about an hour to talk a little bit about that for a few minutes. I also, depending upon whether there's crop circles in eastern Washington, I will be leading a group of people to eastern Washington to look at crop circles. They appear with regularity about once every 2 or 3 years, and the last time it appeared was 2012. So if things go according to schedule, my friends from high above tell us that they should be giving us a good show for crop circles sometime in the middle or end of August in eastern Washington. I'll be taking a group there. With that, I'd like to play a couple of promotions for the sponsors and advertisers for my show, and then I'll be back in just a few minutes with Randy Kramer.
Rochelle Evans. I want to tell you about one of the most exciting fairs this summer. Saturday, July 25th, the Boeing employees will host a Conscious Wellness Expo in Kent, Washington. For years, the Boeing Employees Parapsychology Club, BEPC, has put on the region's largest metaphysical fairs. I've been a part of this for many, many past shows. The fair is free. It's filled with top local speakers, vendors, readers, healers, jewelry, books, and more. The Ted Marr Show will be there. Stop in and say hi. That's the Boeing Conscious Wellness Expo. Open to all. It's free Saturday, July 25th at the Kent Commons from 10 to 4. For details, stop into East West Books, Crystal Voyage or see our webpage, bepcweb.org. Bring non-perishable food and diapers to support Northwest Harvest.
Hello, friends. I'd love to tell you about a wonderful seafood place on the Washington coast. It's called Brady's Oysters. They're located on Highway 105, about 15 miles west of Aberdeen, Washington, in Westport. If you ever go out to the coast and you'd love some seafood, please stop by Brady's Oysters. They have wonderful seafood, including crabs, oysters, clams, salmon, halibut, steelhead, you name it. They've got it. And their prices are extremely reasonable. Their phone number, if you want to give them a call, is 360-268-0077. I've been there myself, and their seafood is great. Friends, I'd like to introduce you to a friend of mine named Orion. He does wonderful computer work. I've hired him myself to do work, and I've been very pleased with everything he does. His website is OrionTechWorks.com. That's OrionTechWorks.com. And Orion, are you there?
I'm right here, buddy.
Okay, great, great. Could you tell my listeners, please, a little bit about the work you do?
Well, I've been basically involved in the computer field since about 1962, actually. I had the first commercial personal computer that was ever sold in America. It was actually sold by Sears Christmas catalog in the 1962 edition. It was virtually a wooden box with some IBM punch cards and some copper rods. You really couldn't do much with it. But it started my my computer career. And so since then, I've been involved in all kinds of different platforms. In the early 80s, when personal computers came out, I actually programmed the first color joystick drawing program that was available, and wrote CAD/CAM software, wrote a lot of database software. When color PCs came into the PC world, you know, the IBM PC world, I jumped on the platform as soon as we came up to 32,000 colors available, which is basically you can do.
Wow.
You know,
well, I just
really great work there.
Wonderful, Orion. Well, I wanted to tell people briefly that Orion's done work for me. I used to have Windows 8.1 operating system. I had all kinds of problems with it, and Orion was able to take it off and replace it with a wonderful new Linux operating system that's very stable, and I have no problems with that whatsoever. But your email is Ted, T-E-D, at OrionTechWorks.com, and your telephone number is 541-633-7340.
And that's correct. Yeah.
And I just want to say that you do wonderful work, and I highly recommend you.
And you can give me my Skype ID, too. For the people that are on Skype, you can get a hold of me at Orion.M1.
All right, Orion.M1. Well, Orion, thank you so much for coming on today. And I know that I want everyone, if you have a computer problem or a software issue, please contact Orion. He'll give you some great help.
Yeah, just email me or call me, and we can take it from there.
Okay. Thank you, Orion, for coming, taking your time today.
Oh, thanks, Ted. And keep up your good work, my friend.
All right. Thank you so much.
News, traffic, and weather? Now you can get your information fixed weekdays on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Hello, friends. We're back, and thank you so much for joining us today. We have on the line Randy Kramer. Randy, are you there?
I am here, Ted.
Welcome. I want to give a little bit about Randy's background. For those of you who don't know Randy, he was on during the last 17 of the last 20 years. Randy lived on Mars. That's right, the planet Mars. He was part of something called the... Now, forgive me, Randy, if I'm making any mistakes, please correct me. But from what you told me, you were part of what's called the Earth Defense Force. You lived on Mars for 17 years, where you said earlier that there were approximately 6 or 7 million people living. Yes, 6 or 7 million. Randy also has visited the dark side of the moon, where he said that there are also millions of people living. There are also several on the North Pole of Mars. I've been told that there were reptilians and insect-like creatures living in that area of Mars, along with two other indigenous human races living on the South Pole. One of the species living in the South Pole of Mars, which is human, has olive skin and pointed ears and are thought to be one of the races which formed the original population of China many thousands of years ago. I met Randy recently at a wonderful UFO conference at James Gillian's East SETI Ranch in Trout Lake, Washington. And after we spoke, within a minute, I immediately invited him on my program because he's had so much interesting to say. One of the things that he told me about is that he'd spent time on something called the galactic starship Nautilus, which he says circles the planet Jupiter. This sacred space program is actually staffed by the countries of the G8, and if my memory serves me correctly, that's Canada, the United States, Japan, Britain, Italy, Germany, and I hope I've covered everyone. Perhaps you can correct me there, Randy. But they have something called the Earth Defense Force. And from what you said earlier, that much of the human population on Mars wants to break away from the home planet of Earth and have its own independent civilization, but they're not quite at the point of independence yet. You've told me that you've been given protection by your superiors to disclose this PACE program. And this is the first time, I believe, that you've been on radio to talk about this. And so, Randy, welcome to Out of This World Radio.
Well, thank you. No, not the first time I've been on radio. Clyde Lewis was the first time I was on radio, like about a year ago.
Okay.
And then he just had me on again just at the end of the conference. And I'm trying to think. I think Alan and Steve at Open Your Mind Radio, and the guy in Ireland, they're also syndicated across Europe. They would have been my second radio show. So I think technically you're my third actual radio show. It doesn't count internet or television. And then a couple of TV spots, one for Japan Network and one for History Channel for Hangar One. So blah, 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 you know.
Wonderful.
Lots of public appearances.
Wonderful.
And you're mostly got all the information correct with a few minor details. I'm not going to go down the list. People,
okay,
I get tired
going
down the list all the time. But
I do my best.
That's all right. People can go to my website, which is earthcitizenconsulting.org. You have all my interviews are up there, and I try and answer all those questions and clarify all of that again and again, but no worries. I'd rather spend time talking substance than nitpicking whether you got my bio right or not. That's totally okay.
Oh, all right. Okay, good. Good, Randy.
It's just not that important, to be honest, as far as, you know, talking about real content or something. So,
all right.
So the Nautilus was an EDF starship that I was aboard as a pilot of an air wing fighter pilot. And the Intergalactic Space Station that orbits Jupiter, two separate entities, but the Intergalactic Space Station is probably the most interesting place that I've ever been because it's essentially a meeting place for anybody and everybody who's in this neck of the woods who needs to have a conversation or a meeting or talk a treaty or work out some kind of a piece of a document or an agreement with somebody, contracts, any sort of level of legal discussion, which from, you know, introductory conversations to, you know, nuts and bolts contracts over trade can be conducted there. And it's a completely neutral area where, you know, no one's allowed to come and start a fight or anything like that. It's all just, you know, a neutral meeting place for people to speak. It's not run by us. It's run by an intergalactic consortium that, you know, manages it. So we are allowed to visit it because we behave ourselves there, and everyone who behaves themselves there gets to return and visit again.
Well, that's good.
If you decide not to behave yourself, that's sort of, you know, when they tell you that you don't get to come back unless you're going to behave. Just pretty simple rules there. And so, yeah, we've behaved ourselves, and so we haven't acted like crazy monkeys or anything, and so they let us keep coming back. And just for, you know, sort of really sort of odd man out reasons, when I was on the Nautilus, I was one of the only flight deck officers who had been infantry trained. So they just kind of wanted to have a thuggy muscle guy really to show up with them, even though there was never any, like I said, no one ever, you know, argued or had physical confrontations, but we come from a culture where we anticipate physical confrontations under any circumstance. So they felt just better having, you know, sort of, you know, someone who could punch somebody in the face. I guess that was going to be necessary, even though it was never necessary. Mm-hmm. And all I really got to do was sit around and be incredibly fascinated by the conversations or incredibly bored by the conversations and more interested in what was going on around the room, depending on what was going on.
Randy, I'm really I have a whole ton of questions here, but one of the things is that if you could describe to my many listeners around the world, Randy, what did the conference room look like? I remember you told some fascinating stories, the incredible views of the Milky Way and Jupiter.
Yeah, I mean, the conference room itself, I'd say, was at least, 100 meters or more around, like in a diameter, in a complete circle with, like, 60 plus foot, you know, incredible view, 360 degrees. You could see Jupiter. You could see, you know, behind. And Jupiter is just nothing really even comes close to trying to understand the scale of that planet, how big it is as a gas giant. When you're really up close to it, even when you're up close to it, you're really far away. You know, being in orbit around Jupiter is a really, really high, far away orbit by comparison to the orbit that you have in other smaller planetary bodies. You know, your elevation above the surface is just so many more hundreds of thousands of miles. Wow. But it's still so huge. It's still just so gigantic. So it's quite an experience. I have to say that, quite an experience. And at any given time, you're going to have dozens of different species who are having conversations, engaged in some kind of dialogue, and varying from verbal dialogues to psionic dialogues to, like, interpreter-assisted dialogues. And I mean, there's all kinds of different ways that people address communication issues across the board. There's not one solution all the time. There are a variety of solutions for that.
I know my many listeners are I'm psychic and I pick up things, and people are asking me now what do they look like? What do the other entities look like out there? Tall ones, fat ones, short ones, big ones, little ones?
Really the variance of size, shape, what I would say, evolutionary building blocks. I mean, you can sometimes tell pretty obviously what sort of pre-earlier, you know, more primitive species that being or person came from, because some of the traits are more obvious than others. Mm-hmm. Other times, it's really difficult to tell, you know, and mm-hmm. so you sort of have a more evolved or even genetically engineered or tampered evolved being that's more specific to its task or its level of evolution and wherever its culture is sort of relates to. But I mean, really, from the very small, you know, I can remember, gosh, I mean, they couldn't have been more than 18 inches high.
Really?
In little silver spacesuits. I mean, it was kind of cute, right? I mean, want to go, oh, you're so cute. I mean, because they might not appreciate that. But it was almost cute, you know, these little 18-inch, you know, guys in these little silver spacesuits.
Well, were they human appearing, or did they look like insects? Or
I mean, I would call these bipedal locomotive, you know, sort of humanoid type, but I couldn't really see their faces. I could just see their arms and their legs. And,
I see.
You know, but they had sort of a singular head.
Interesting.
They had a faceplate over their little helmet. But really, the variance is about as wide as you could think. So from the very small to the very, very large to a number of different mammalian, reptilian, amphibian, insectoid, and even sort of, you know, more water habitating, you know, mammalioid or fish species even. I mean, you know, really just keep going a gambit.
Mermaid, like, did they have, like, half fish, half human, like mermaids?
I wouldn't say a half person, half fish. I would say something that was more like a sentient, you know, eel that, you know, was in a tank, you know, so that it could communicate across it at a table next to someone that was not in a tank. Depending on what they, you know, they may need to breathe or exist in that environment, they sort of can create, you know, sort of different circumstances. So, I mean, it's kind of some interesting, it's, when you're looking around the room, some very interesting, like, just two people sitting across a table, or maybe someone very giant sitting at a very large table with a very tiny table on top of it with some very tiny people sitting at that table, or someone sitting at a table across from someone in a tank, or two people across each other from enclosed tanks with completely different.
Fascinating. Well, what are they? One of the things that you told me too was that, well, let me get back real quick. How did, I assume they don't use English, these other species. Do they communicate with you telepathically, or are there translators there that are able to interpret the different languages? How do they communicate with you?
Quite a number varied of options. Sometimes they actually could speak English, but I would say more often than not there was some sort of intermediary, which would include a technological universal translator, a psionic translator, a direct psionic amplifier communication device, and or their ability to sort of communicate psionically assisted, you know, was good enough for us to be able to communicate with them. So there's a wide variety depending on that species' makeup and their ability to communicate.
Fascinating, fascinating. Now, you mentioned psionics. I went to your wonderful presentation you gave at James Gillian's UFO Ranch here a few weeks ago, but could you please explain psionics for our listeners who are not familiar with the term?
Sure. Psionics are essentially the scientific terminology for the projected energy that is emitted from thought. So the first law of psionics is that, you know, all thought produces psionic energy.
All right. Interesting. Interesting. So it's a little bit, is it a little bit like mental telepathy?
Well, it's essentially any and all projected energy from thought. So, and essentially any manifested ability that thought has to do to manipulate matter, energy, or yourself is essentially psionic ability. So I know people like to use that other PS word, but we don't. And in the military, we use the psionic term to essentially describe, because it's essentially governed by laws of physics, the laws of psionics, which are laws of physics, and essentially we train people to be able to sort of use that in a very grounded, practical sense. That I mean, it still allows people to remote view and communicate, you know, psionically, telepathically, you know, see through time space and up and down the time stream. All of those things are sort of just what your mind can tap into as it expands its ability to function.
Well, I have to mention this to you, Randy, because I'm a big fan of the Moto Peace Project and the Moto Office in Tokyo. I'm sure you're familiar with the late Dr. Masaru Moto, who,
oh, of course, yeah.
Wonderful man who passed away last year. There's a wonderful project they have. They have many wonderful projects, including the Moto Peace Project, who's headed up by Michiko Hayashi. She's doing wonderful work there. One of the projects they're working on, of course, is producing anti-cancer water for the children of Fukushima. And actually, in a week's time, for my listeners listening, we'll be having a show on that. But the psionics sounds very much like the work of Dr. Emoto, who found scientifically that people, when you direct positive thoughts, for example, to a glass of water, the water itself it has these beautiful crystals which suddenly occur on the molecular level. But if you send negative thoughts, Randy, to another glass of water, the molecular structure of the water crystals actually breaks down into ugly forms. And so the work of Dr. Moto's office has been to try to foster love and gratitude throughout the world to literally create a much better and happier world. And psionics sounds very much like the work of Dr. Moto on a scientific basis.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. People can, you know, have been doing psionic work for a very, very, very long time. Mm-hmm. And whether they call it that or not is, you know, just a matter of terminology or where they are in time and space. But essentially, you know, one of our hopes and goals is to not just talk about it, but there is sort of like going from talking about the laws of psionics to laboratory psionics, to being able to demonstrate, you know, how these laws function as laws of physics, with measuring apparatus and so forth in a Faraday cage. It takes some setup to do it, to do the lab work. But the whole point is to go through those steps, write up a paper, and then be able to demonstrate, you know, that we're not just talking about, you know, an ability that some people think they have or some people think they don't have or some people have or don't have, but we're talking about an actual act of the laws of physics that everyone wants to understand, has that innate ability to begin to understand the basic, simple, fundamental skills that allow you to focus and enhance that. A lot of the real separation is the left and right sides of the brain and whether you believe something or whether you understand something. And when you both understand it and believe it is when you're in a whole-minded state. And essentially every methodology that I've ever learned is that mastery of the mind and self-mastery is all about achieving whole-minded states, balance, hemispherical states whenever possible. So essentially when you can both understand and believe something is when you actually have true psionic development and, you know, you can achieve sort of maximum psionic potential. So we like to think that we're a psionically emergent species moving towards being a psionic species. And the sooner we get there, the better.
Well,
because it's just a better state of
Well, I can't tell you how interesting your work is. And Randy, one thing, if you could speak up a little bit, my friend, you fade out just a little bit, but I can hear you fine. I just want to make sure my listeners can hear you.
Sure.
One of the things, and this is very important to note that just briefly, I want to talk about Dr. Emoto's work with his water crystals. During his lifetime and even now, his work often gets criticized by narrow-minded third-dimensional Earth scientists who don't believe that he did true science.
Well, they did a double blind that absolutely worked, and the triple blind was only minorly inconclusive, but it kind of still had an effect. So, the double and the triple blind test, I think, showed that it was actually very scientific.
Well, I just want to mention this on the air because I was going to... I have run into some opposition here, for example, in the Seattle area. I'm not going to name names, but there is one particular place who considers Dr. Emoto's work not true science. It's too out there, and they're very narrow-minded. But for those listening who don't believe in this work, there's a whole branch of the military now that has something called psionics, which is scientific proof, I think, of this particular field. And I think eventually this will leak into the mainstream science so that the work that you do now will become more mainstream in the coming years. Randy, are you there?
Oh, yes, I am. Sorry, I'm hearing some overlay of something, other audio or music or something in my ear that's sort of confusing. So,
okay, all right. Sorry, my friend.
Not sure where that's coming from.
Yeah.
Sounds like someone talking in Japanese, actually. So, and there's music and everything, and so I'm kind of having a hard time hearing you.
Well, we have wonderful sound equipment here, and it's nothing from our end. I do know that sometimes when I bring on guests in the program that there are attempts to interfere with our transmissions, but I'm just going to stick the course and ignore the other.
Oh, no
other
worries.
Sounds.
And that would not be the first time that I've had an interview with someone and there was, you know, audio-visual interference that's actually occurred a number of times.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you letting me know that you're good on that end, and then I can just appreciate that then someone's trying to, you know, send some kind of crazy cross signal. Because it actually sounds like interference from either Japanese radio or television program. Or it's like commercials and music and then people talking in Japanese. It's very kind of surreal at the moment trying to hear what you're saying and hear that piping in my ear at the same time. So just to point out that that's what's happening here. So
well, okay, good, good. Well, I have a lot of listeners in Japan. And I hope they're. I'm sure they're enjoying the program. Well, there's a lot of things I want to really ask you, Aunt Randy, including. Now you went to the moon as well, didn't you? In addition to
for a little bit, yeah. I mean, the first trip out essentially is a trip from the Earth to the moon, and then from LOC, Lunar Operations Command. There's, you know, basically a trip down to the medical unit to get, you know, through your final medical exam, and then there's going down to the administration section and going through the contract, you know, initial here, sign here, and, you know, eventually you get done and someone explains that off to you and you go on your way with your packet, and then kind of an indeterminable amount of time just because, you know, there's no sort of sun or clock to tell you when it is. And then we got on board a much larger transport and took off to Mars. And then stopped there on the way back. So really my only recollection, you know, is having been there kind of at service duty time a couple of times from the training period, which was, you know, much younger when I was a kid, if there were a few visits to the dark side for training exercises and so forth. But a lot of that is just sort of interfused with a lot of childhood memory. So it's sometimes it's really sharp and really clear, but it's also like playground memory, so sometimes it's a little more vague.
Interesting. How long did it take you to go from the moon to Mars?
About 90 minutes, probably. Oh, I'm sorry, from Earth to moon is about 90 minutes. From moon to Mars, I mean, it was like 15, 20. I mean, the flight procedures probably took longer than the actual trips because the ship apparently took a wormhole, you know, jump gate from the moon to Mars. It was a very, very short trip.
And I haven't been there myself, but do you know how many miles? It must be an incredible distance to travel that far, that fast, that quickly.
Yeah, I have no idea. I haven't looked it up to see how many miles that is again, but it's a bunch. I mean, it's hundreds of thousands or, you know, billions of miles, billions of miles or something. Wow. I mean, it's a ton or whatever. Wow. It's a bunch. And it is a long ways out. I can tell you that from being a pilot, we don't count in miles. We count in astronomical units or astros. So, I mean, things are much, much larger, you know, when you're sort of thinking about it. And, but I can definitely say that you feel like you're covering huge amounts of distance, but at the same time, when you are looking at the map of, you know, what sector you actually covered, this very tiny grid, and so that there does seem to be this still, there's a scale of everything still being really, really large. Even when you have really fast vehicles and you can travel back and forth pretty quickly, there's still definitely a very real scale of things just being very, very large, and we are very tiny out there.
One of the things that I heard years ago from a whistleblower out at Area 51 is that they had somehow gotten a hold of extraterrestrial propulsion systems, which actually were activated by thought. And I was wondering if you had heard anything like of those kind of propulsion systems. I mean, how do they operate to go from the planet Earth to the Moon and to Mars?
Essentially, a being which is either psionically emergent enough to operate a psionic amplifier, mm-hmm. or a psionic being that's psionic enough to operate a psionic amplifier, or be amplified enough to operate a psionic operating system. Essentially, the organic, you know, electronic interface happens with psionics. So, again, that's another reason for wanting to get the physics done and demonstrate how, you know, this is laws of physics, and therefore there's a link between how that actually happens and real electrical mechanical things happen, so that you can start to link up the ability to connect the mind and different machines without just plugging in, you know, a neural interface. A neural interface, you know, is totally different. It's like creating a port inside the back of your skull, which is not the same thing as creating a psionic interface, which is just being able to interact with your brain waves, essentially, and your psionic emission brain, which is also essentially brain waves,
sure.
To interact with that machine or that device. So, yeah, there are certainly some advanced ETs that are psionic enough or have good amplifiers, and can pilot their vehicles essentially with, you know, just psionics with thought.
Sure. Well, one thing I just want to
say, I know we're working on those things. I know we're absolutely working on those things. I don't know exactly what level we've achieved on those.
Sure.
We didn't really have, you know, a psionic interface on our vehicle. We essentially had the HUD interface had a psionic interface, so there was sort of things that you were seeing visually in your head that were projected across the display of what you were looking at, like in the head-up display, which is kind of a little surreal. But it was not a mentally driven vehicle. We still had to pilot it with, you know, hand controls.
Okay. For those who are just tuning in, this is Out of This World Radio with your host, Ted Marr, broadcasting from the studios of KKNW here in on 1150 AM in Bellevue, Washington, just right next to Seattle. We have, for our interview running until 4 o'clock Seattle time for the next hour and a half, the fascinating account by Randy Kramer of his experience on Mars and Moon in the Earth Defense Force. It's a secret space program paid for by in part by American taxpayers, but we know nothing about it. Is this where what do the people do on Mars other than live there, Randy? Are they engaged in scientific research or manufacturing?
I would imagine there's quite a bit of scientific research, because there's certainly quite a bit of research in military hardware, and my understanding is there's definitely some mining and manufacturing going on. My understanding is we build stuff really well, and so many, many other systems in the galaxy want to buy our stuff. Oh. And so we have essentially a pretty deplorable labor conditions at the moment, which I understand are under review and inspection because they're violation of various treaties. But, yeah, we do have pretty much what Richard Dolan calls the breakaway civilization. The full attempt of the Cabal and their breakaway civilization has been to make Mars as self-sufficient as possible, you know, industry-wise, you know, medical research-wise, technical, scientific research-wise, just essentially to make them as completely independent from us as possible so that they can break away, having their own banking system, everything. But I would say that that has not been a complete process by any means, and it's kind of in the middle of that, not of that falling apart, because they've come to light that they're in a number of violations of treaties and so forth that are being reviewed, and so there's some inspections and some reviews at the moment. I know that everybody's not always happy when there's just inspections. People want, you know, to give them a head thumping, but inspections are part of the process. But I think we're making progress with inspections.
Well, When you mentioned the term deplorable human rights conditions, I don't want to go there today unless it's the truth, but are they enforced labor? Are they sort of like the slave labor camps Joseph Stalin used to have, or the concentration camps the Nazis had?
I mean, from what reports we've gotten back so far, they're more just like Kafka-esque, you know, sort of conditions where a family of four, you know, lives in a 12-by-12 room, you know, essentially, and you know, works pretty long hour, long day, work week conditions. So, I mean, you're kind of talking labor movement conditions, and you're definitely talking about people living in very tiny spaces for little or no resources compared to what the value of their labor is, you know, being extracted from them. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that because of the conditions there, you know, there's a certain amount of quality medical treatment that these people get, but I'm sure there's also a very high social Darwinist sort of view that if workers become too injured or too damaged and they don't want it too costly to repair, easy to get rid of them or replace them, then I'm sure that they're exterminated pretty readily and pretty quickly.
It doesn't sound like it's a place that has many human values, benevolent values.
Well, that's been the problem, is that the, you know, when people want to talk about the cabal, it's a complex organization of individuals who, over time, over since the end of World War II and the formation of the secret space program and the first Martian colonies, you know, over time became this infiltrated, you know, Operation Paperclip, Nazi eugenic social Darwinist, you know, kind of thing, to where the leadership really, really steered the agenda in a far, far, far direction than what most of the other originators of the covert military space program and MJ-12 committee and so forth were shooting for. So there was, it's important for people to understand there was secrecy was sort of created to try and solve a problem that we really didn't know much about before we brought it to the public eye. And then as that problem was being sorted out, it got hijacked because of its sort of very covert nature. It made it even easier for these sort of Nazi intelligence program people to sort of hijack the covert military space programs. And it's not that the entire space programs are run by Nazis. It's just that they sort of took over the banking and management process that, you know, has militarily run and controlled the colony. So they've essentially been able to sort of impose this pretty fascist, you know, authoritarian rule system over the colonies and over the Mars Defense Force in such a way that without somebody else, you know, coming in and changing that policy, or without, you know, some other type of revolt from within, which, you know, we're hearing some interesting stories about people, you know, getting out and defecting and, you know, being able to sort of, you know, get amnesty and, you know, I mean, sort of how the reason that some of this has come to light is because of sort of people coming out and, you know, defecting or leaving, or, you know, leaving the colonies or escaping these sort of deplorable conditions to report
them to someone else.
So it's a process where we're understanding what happened over decades, which was this very slow, quiet takeover by this very fascist, militaristic, right-wing sort of cabal. Mm-hmm. And now we're seeing that being fully implemented as, and it coming apart in the same way that it's coming apart here on Earth. You know, anyone who studies history knows that far right-wing authoritarian, you know, fascist regimes, if they don't really lock everybody down within a certain period of time, they will eventually be, you know, pushed back and blow back. And
I guess
they've kind of gone past their point of being able to lock everybody down.
Sure.
You know, there's different blowback and pushback. So I would say that we're trying to learn more. We're trying to understand exactly what the conditions are. We're trying to learn more with these inspections and investigations, trying to get down to the bottom of it, trying to change conditions. But we're in the middle of an ugly process, and that's about all I can say about that. But
well, I want to thank you so much for disclosing this on the air. My my radio show is very popular here in the Seattle area. I'm also heard up in Vancouver and Victoria, Canada, as well as in over 60 countries around the world. So you're having a worldwide audience today, and I know I am finding this really interesting. One of the questions I've had since World War II is that there was a lot of activity in the Antarctic area called New Schwabland. I think that's right. The Germans called it that.
Correct. Right, New Schwabenland, yeah.
Schwabenland, yeah. And they had quietly during the 30s and during World War II, actually, too, shifted many thousands of scientists, German scientists down there, resources of the Nazi government, to this area to start off basically a new civilization. Are they on the moon, by the way? Is there a remnant break off of them on the moon or Mars?
The short answer would be yes.
Okay.
The long answer would be that I think that there was some merging of these techno-industrial factions post-World War II, post the sort of Operation High Jump, you know, mm-hmm. sort of during the Cold War, where the breakaway Nazis in Antarctica with a little citadel they called Valkyrie 2 were, you know, essentially they weren't going anywhere. We weren't extracting them. So by the 50s and the 60s, I think it became just a matter that they became a factor to negotiate with. And so the New Schwabenlanders, you know, became sort of this quiet group of people that we kind of didn't really recognize or talk about, but was recognized by the United Nations and recognized by other world governments to, you know, as far as diplomacy was concerned, because they now had a fact, they had a stake, and they essentially had staked a military stake in such a way that you couldn't extract them, they weren't going away, but they couldn't, you know, they knew that they couldn't just, sorry about the taking over the world thing, you know, but we're going to, now we're, you know, at the table with everybody.
Interesting.
So, which I think is why the National Geographic map of Antarctica up until 2010, and they changed it after 2010, up until 2010 had New Schwabenland on it. And an important point about, you know, signing the treaties is that, you know, Germany had to get rid of all conquered and acquired land. Well, New Schwabenland would have been acquired land, so they would have had to give it up, and technically it would have been part of the Swedish sort of section with this large sort of chunk of Antarctica there.
Interesting.
But interestingly, so technically it should have been off the books, it should have been off the map in 1945, and
right.
It should have been just Sweden, but New Schwabenland was on the National Geographic map until 2010, until they changed it. So,
Fascinating.
I thought that was very interesting.
Have you visited their facilities on the moon? Are they part of the facilities on the moon? There's no separation.
Oh, there are so many bases and facilities on the back of the moon. It's kind of a DMZ where there are people who have been there longer than we have. You know, mm-hmm. basically we can't just say, hey, we're on the moon now, get out of here, and they can go like, we've been here for a couple hundred thousand years, we're not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. So, you know, basically it's a DMZ in order to, you know, keep it from being blown out of the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone who has a base there is allowed to have a base there and supposedly not supposed to attack or threaten or do anything shenanigans-wise to their neighbors. So I haven't seen, by any means, all of the bases that are on the backside of the moon. I've only been to a very limited corner of whatever I was at, for sure, and most
I
of
see.
It underground, and very little memory of the above-ground lunar surface or any such thing, mostly just underground facilities with boring concrete walls and, you know, military paint jobs.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, you say military paint jobs. I assume what flags do you see? Is there the U.S. flag and then the Russian flag and then perhaps the British flag, or what flags do you see up there?
You know, usually you don't see too many, but mostly when you're in, I mean, as an American military personnel, mostly managed by other American military personnel, you know, you'll mm-hmm. see people in either American military uniforms or EDF uniforms. And the EDF doesn't necessarily fly a flag, but it does have a patch. So
mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of flag waving. There's not a lot of, like, identification markers of what's going on in places. I mean, even when you're there, there's still a sense that everything's really secretive. You know, there's mm-hmm. not a lot of doors that are labeled, just lots of either do not enters or doors that are locked if you're not mm-hmm. supposed to go that way. And
mm-hmm.
there, you know, people standing, you know, guards and escorts and things at very convenient locations, so that in a way you end up feeling like, you know, you're being ushered around like cattle. you know, up and down this way and that way, but not that way or the other way.
Sure.
So, and at times that I can remember, you know, being there, very clear distinctions between what were secure areas and what were non-secure areas for different levels of personnel. So
interesting.
It's still a very, very secretive place in that sense, I think.
A mutual friend of ours, Dr. Michael Sala, is a wonderful UFO researcher. He's been on my show before, and I recently read an article on his website about, I think he talked about an interview he'd had with you, Randy. And one of the things he mentioned in his article, if my memory serves me correctly, was the ICC, the Interplanetary Corporate Conglomerate, or conglomeration. It was made up of Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, and various other Earth corporations.
Right.
And do you, could you tell our listeners, my listeners, a little bit about that, if you know anything? I don't know a thing about it, but I just read briefly on
Yeah, I mean, there are these different umbrellas of military and financial authority. So when I was on Mars, you know, I was a member of the Mars Defense Force, or the MDF. The MDF is contracted by the MCC, which is the Mars Colony Corporation. Now, the Mars Colony Corporation is going to be underneath one of the other subsidiaries of the ICC, or the Interplanetary Corporate Conglomerate, which is this economy of industry, mining, and production that exists off-world, as well as the corporations and businesses who all sort of, you know, got their stake in it when they had to build it up in the 40s and 50s and 60s using mostly American industrial contractors, but as well as Soviet industrial contractors and other European and Asian industrial contractors over time. So everyone who's got a big enough contract to have a stake in it at some point, you know, gets to play with the big boys at some level, and it gives scientists and engineers and gives personnel to support that effort. So anyone who's benefiting or developing industry for that program is also dedicating time, money, energy, personnel to that system so that it can stay functioning.
Well, I find your what you're having to say, Randy, incredibly interesting, and I'm so glad that I have you on till 4 o'clock today. So we've got well over an hour. But one thing I have to ask you, I don't remember ever taking a vote on this. Do you?
No. It was never a thing we got to vote on. That was, I mean, Truman. I think, you know, when he set up the MJ-12 committee, knew that we were going to have to do quite a bit of research before we ever got to a place where we were going to be in space or space mining. I think it happened a lot sooner than he thought it did. And Eisenhower certainly knew that, you know, we were going to end up with changes down the road that we were going to have to deal with. But I think that the early persons who were sort of in the decision-making process when they made the decision to sort of keep things secret, did not anticipate just how quickly and how far it would be able to run without them, and you would have colonies and industry and contractors, you know, subcontracting to build this and do that and pull rocks out of here. I think it just got away from everybody pretty quickly, except for the people who were managing the money, who knew very well what was happening and were very, very clearly understanding of how much money was being made. And when they started looking at the numbers, started saying, wow, you know, we could just totally get away from this other planet here, and maybe we don't have to deal with this anymore at all, and we could just, all those problems that we're going to have to deal with down the road, maybe we could just not deal with them by flushing the whole planet down the toilet.
I see. Really, so in other words, flush here, people on Earth and this planet down the toilet, so that their cabal-run planet on Mars and Moon would survive. Is that right? So they
precisely. Yeah,
I
precisely.
See. Wow. Very interesting. The other point I'd like to bring up quickly, we've got a few minutes here left of the first hour, is how do they, I mean, as you know, the United States and the other so-called developed countries on this planet run on oil, petroleum. Planes fly on, of course, we drive on it. But you don't, apparently you don't need oil on Mars and the Moon? There's other sources of energy?
Pretty much everything is either micro-nuclear, you know, these sort of small atomic generators that are like the size of a dishwasher, or other larger, more powerful electron pumps or fusion generators. Or, I mean, it's all pretty high-tech stuff, and I'm not privy to every level of energy generation that they are capable of, but I can certainly say that I saw plenty of these micro-atomic generators and talked about the larger atomic generator under our base at Forward Station Zebra and on the Nautilus, was not allowed in the engineering section, but the engineers seemed to indicate that they had multiple kinds of energy generation to function under a variety of different circumstances when one or more might not work. You might need a different type of energy source to operate the vehicle. So they seem to have a number of things that they had going on back there and weren't talking about.
I just wanted to say this real quick before I forget. Randy, how can the people and the cabal running these the civilizations on Mars and the Moon with these other wonderful free energy sources not share it with the population of this planet while we're struggling to get by? I think of that every time I fill up my tank full of gas, of course, because I think that I know that there's better ways to get around, far cheaper, less expensive,
right,
and less environmentally hazardous than there is oil. And why don't they release those technologies to the people here on the planet? Why are they so selfish to keep these technologies for their own use and these other breakaway civilizations?
That is a perfectly good question. I will say that most of the time when people ask the question, hey, how can those people be so selfish?
Right.
You are often projecting a certain kind of humane reasonability onto them that we presume, or you may presume, is mm-hmm. part of their psychological profile.
Right.
I can tell you that their psychological profile is what explains this, and their psychological profile is they are feudalist social Darwinists. Okay, that really explains who and what they are. And so they believe in a, you know, survival of the fittest elite who get to rule over a survival of the fittest serfdom who should be just darn happy, you know, that they have labor to toil at and any amount of food, you know, to eat whatsoever because, you know, it's handed to them by their masters.
I see. So
they don't like democracy. They don't like law. They want things to be, you know, feudalist social Darwinist. That mm-hmm. is what they love, and that is how that is their psychological profile, and this comes from the sort of whole Nazi eugenics philosophy.
I see.
So as well as their sort of, you know, old school aristocracy sort of philosophy merging with the sort of eugenics into feudalist social Darwinist. So as far as they're concerned, you and I are breathing their air, drinking their water, otherwise consuming their resources that they should have to decide to do what they want to do with, and we should all just go away and die and be happy about it.
Randy, real quick, my friend, I just want to say this, then we're going on a break here in about a minute and a half. But so if one of these people who are running the other human civilizations on Mars or the Moon came to planet Earth here, and I'm sure they visit every once in a while, and they run into one of the many homeless sometimes you see on American streets, they would, is it callous to say that they would just as soon run over some poor guy or a woman with children on the street asking for a handout then look at them? Is that true? According to their mindset? I mean, these people are expendable if they
don't
absolutely.
Make it? Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. I mean, they come essentially right from a system of languaging, you know, about subhumans and stinky surface dwellers, you know, anyone who's not, you know, in an underground advanced civil, you know, structure or off world is a stinky surface dweller.
Right.
And so stinky surface dwellers are, you know, uneducated, ungenetically augmented, unadvanced, you know, serfs who don't deserve to live. I mean, they have this very, very harsh, social Darwinist feudalist attitude. And right. I would caution anyone who thinks that they can project any kind of rational, compassionate attitude onto these people and then ask, why are they doing that? The short answer is because, you know, they're jerks, and the long answer is because their psychological profile is feudalist social Darwinist.
My friends, please hold on. We're going on to take a short break here. We'll be back in a few minutes with Randy Kramer talking about his time on Mars and the Moon and the secret space program.